Hello?
This call is being recorded.
Karen!
Okay. Hey, Jennifer, how are you doing?
Hey! It's so good to hear your voice. How are
you? Nice to hear yours. You doing okay?
Yeah, I am. How about you?
Everything's going great.
I'm so glad. Thanks so much for talking to me today.
Well,
I'm so excited to
I hope I have something to add. My memory's not as great as it used to be, but we'll see what we can do.
Well, so I'll introduce myself for the recording. This is Jennifer Blomquist. I'm the archivist at DeKalb History Center. I'm talking to Karen Chance, former employee of DeKalb History Center, among her other many talents. So, Karen, I usually ask people to start from the beginning. So do you mind starting with where you were born, where you grew up, where you went to school, and all that sort of good stuff, and we'll go from there.
Sure. I was born in Wilmington, Delaware, 1960, and grew up in Newark, Delaware, which is just about 15 miles south of there, and lived there until I was 18, and moved to Atlanta for art college. Went to the Atlanta College of Art, which no longer exists, but was absorbed into Savannah College of Art and Design.
Okay. Where was, so was the school downtown?
It was the building that is next to the High Museum of Art, the Memorial Arts Center, on the third and fourth floors of that building. And it was built in response to the Orly Field plane crash that happened, where all the arts advocates were killed. And then they established the symphony, and the museum at the time was in the bottom floor of that building. And the art college was, like I said, top two floors.
And then, so what did you study?
At the beginning, they have you do foundation studies, which is a little bit of everything. And then in your second year, you're supposed to choose a major. And I chose, at the time, printmaking. But I kind of decided partway into that year that really I was more interested in photography, and mm-hmm. then went on to do photography as my major. But luckily, there was sort of some crossover between the two. So mm-hmm. it worked out.
Okay. And then did you find employment right away, or did you work as a freelance, or what did you do once you finished school?
Well, I was actually working at the Feminist Women's Health Center while I was in school, worked a couple of days a week there. And so I worked at the health center a little bit longer after I got out of school, and then realized that, you know, I didn't really want to do that forever. And so then I proceeded to work a bunch of disconnected jobs. Mm-hmm. I worked in a wood shop building furniture, or I should say my job was to make furniture parts. So I would, you know, make a chair arm, or I'd make a chair leg or whatever, but never actually made the whole chair. But it was a pretty good job. I learned a lot about using shop tools, and met some nice people there, and sort of a bunch of hippies. And then I was lucky enough to get my first museum-related job at the Center for Puppetry Arts, where mm-hmm. I worked as the assistant to the museum director, Diane Kempler. And it was a job that was just temporarily funded through a grant, so it wasn't something that I could do forever, but I really liked it. And that was my first job working exhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
And also helping to catalog the puppets and untangling an enormous number of marionette strings. So.
Oh, wow. I can only imagine how that
yeah,
was.
It was lovely, and scraping old foam that had started to break down off of things, and so it was interesting. But but Diane was a great person to work for, and really enjoyed that. So,
can I go back to your work at the Feminist Women's Health Center? It's June of 2022, and Roe versus Wade has just been overturned by the Supreme Court.
Yes.
I was wondering what kind of work was done at the health center, and was abortion one of the services that was offered?
Yes, it was. I saw an ad in the paper. I was looking for a part-time job, and I saw an ad in the Creative Loafing that said, "Are you interested in working for social change?" And I thought, yes, I am. And I went with a friend who also went to ACA, and we applied for jobs there. And Rhonda, my friend, ended up being very, very good at being a patient facilitator and helping women through the whole process. I was more of a behind-the-scenes person, and I worked in the sterile room, dealing with making up instrument trays and that kind of thing. But yes, we did. It was primarily an abortion clinic, but also did well woman, programs where during the week, I guess they just did abortions 2 days a week. And then the rest of the time it was pregnancy tests and just basic pap smears and the usual. And educational programs and things like that. A lot of really great women worked there.
Mm-hmm.
And, most of the people that worked there really wanted just to help other women and make health care available that had not been available to them, and
right.
make it a little bit less scary and less it a little bit more approachable.
How long did you work there?
3 years.
And then before you said you worked at the Center for Puppetry Arts. How long were you at the Center for Puppetry Arts?
I think that was just about a year. Like I said, that was a grant-funded position, so once the money ran out, that was that. So.
And then when did you end up at I know that you worked at the Carlos Museum at Emory for a time. Tell us about that. When did you
Yes.
work there?
Well, first I worked for Gary Lee Super Associates. Was my first job working exhibits, sort of freelance, where we went around to different museums. And I guess that's how I ended up making the acquaintance of Nancy Roberts, who was the head of the exhibition design department at the Heim Museum at the time. And then Nancy eventually moved over to the Carlos Museum and became the head of exhibition over there. So I had done a little bit of freelance work for her, and I guess she was happy with the work I did. And so I applied there and got the job, and I guess that was around 2000.
Mm-hmm.
It's either 2000 or 2001.
And how long did you work at the Carlos?
Just shy of 4 or 5 years.
And then what's the story about the, so tell us some, so I want to hear some of the stories from the Carlos, because there was one in particular that stands out from when you and I used to talk here at work about the, there was a mummy story from the Carlos that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Do you mind sharing that one?
Was that the one where we were talking about Ramses?
Yeah.
Or which one was?
Yeah.
Remind me which story that was.
I don't know if it had been properly tagged or if it hadn't been found, or like I feel like you guys found it somehow, or it was.
Oh, yeah. So that's Ramses. That was slightly before my time, but the guy that was in charge of the Egyptian collection, Peter Lacavera, was very well connected to all the people who were doing Egyptology. And so whenever anything interesting would pop up somewhere, people would call him and say, hey, you might want to take a look at this. And so there was this flea bag little museum up in Niagara. I'm not in positive about this, but I think it might have been sort of like a Ripley's kind of museum. It would be easy enough to double check that. But it was one of those things where they had the two-headed cow, and then they had some mummies and some other weird things like that. And someone took a look at this stuff because the museum was going out of business. And this Egyptologist took a look at it and said, hey, you know, this actually looks like really good stuff. It just in a little rough condition. It needs a little repair and, you know, conservation. And but the quality of the painting on the sarcophagus, you know, lids and stuff was really top-notch. And so they thought maybe there was something to it. And so they bought this collection. And through researching it, eventually came to the realization that one of the mummies was Ramses. Pharaoh Ramses. And so eventually it was determined that we would return Ramses to Egypt, but they did allow us to put him on display for an exhibit for a while before we had to give him back. And
you mentioned the Ramses story came before your time. Do you have any memories, recollections of exhibits that you worked on at the Carlos that stand out?
Well, I mean, I enjoyed all my work at the Carlos, but we did have some. So we had a Gordon Parks exhibit. That was the first one that I worked on. Was a photography exhibit. Most of the work at the Carlos, most of the exhibits there are antiquities, but they do have works on paper exhibits that are more modern works. And so the Gordon Parks exhibit was a photography exhibit, and it was a really good one. And we at one point had Jack Kerouac's On the Road scroll, you know, the long typewritten scroll that he taped together. I think
wow.
It was like 25 feet long or something. And we had that
wow.
on display. And I don't know, we had the lots of Greek and Roman and Cycladic and all kinds of interesting things. I mean, I think the Carlos is worth a trip for anybody who visits Atlanta.
Yeah. It is a they great museum.
So you've been?
I have, yeah. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It has a collection that is unlike any other in Atlanta.
Right.
And it just has that
so
nice...
I was gonna...
Oh, and I forgot we had a the head of Caligula. It wasn't really his head. It was a sculpture of his head. But it was one of the most valuable things that we had at the time. And it was brought to us in a gym bag wrapped in a towel.
Oh, my goodness.
It's amazing. It is amazing sometimes people who are collectors, you know, it belongs to them, so they treat it the way they feel like treating it. But I think the thing was worth close to $1 million. And but yeah, it was wrapped in a towel in a gym bag, and that's how they brought it in. And
wow.
So.
Well, I know you've heard this before, but one of the last exhibits you worked on here at the History Center was the Ranch House exhibit.
Yeah.
And I think it is probably by far, just from what I've heard from people, the most popular in recent history, the most popular exhibit. It's my favorite of all time. That is one of my that's a wonderful exhibit that you put on, and people are still we still have people come in looking for it. Where's the Ranch House exhibit?
Well, and that is really nice. That's really nice to hear that. I was looking on Facebook the other day and was scrolling along, and all of a sudden a picture of it popped up, and I was kind of startled. I was like, that looks familiar. And yes. So yeah, it's nice that it resonated with people. My guess is, you know, everybody could look at that exhibit and find something in it that they remembered or that was at their grandmother's house or, that they grew up with. And even if not, it just had some really nice design elements, and that mid-century modern furniture and style is, you know, something that anybody can appreciate.
It's such a popular topic with folks that visit us or follow us on socials. That mid-century modern look is very popular still.
Yeah.
So before we get to your time at DeKalb History Center, I'm going to backtrack a lot probably. Sorry about that. But I wanted to talk more about your advocacy. You obviously were an advocate and interested in social change, working at the Feminist Women's Health Center, but you're also an advocate for LGBTQ rights. And I'm hoping you'll talk about, you've been sharing some pictures with me, and I'm hoping you'll tell the full stories of those two. You had one incident in 87 with Michael Hardwick, and then you had another one in the 90s. So do you mind talking
I like,
a bit about
I like the word Hardwick. Incident. That's funny. It was the first one with Michael Hardwick was the March on Washington in 1987, October 1987. And it was, I think it was only the second national gay and lesbian rights march at that point. And I went to that. I had been on the planning committee for that for most of that year, prior to that year, and I think near the end of it, something came up, and I wasn't able to keep going with it. So there was a little break, but I went anyway to the march. My partner at the time, Holly, and I went. And when we got there, we saw a flyer that was talking about the fact that they were going to do civil disobedience at the Supreme Court the day after the march. And we were planning to be there in the area for a few days. And so we talked it over and decided that we would look into it further and went to a little informational session the night before. And we were walking down this hallway, I remember, and going past a doorway where somehow or other we caught the name Michael Hardwick. And, of course, we were both very, that was the reason we were there in the first place, was the Hardwick decision had been so offensive to us that we decided that we really needed to do something to respond to that. And it turned out that Michael Hardwick and a couple of people were looking for a couple of extra folks to join their little group that because everybody had their little action group for this civil disobedience arrest thing. And since we were from...
Can I just ask you real quick about Michael Hardwick? So it's my understanding, I read about him after you and I were texting a couple weeks ago, and I hadn't heard of him before, so I read about him. And it's my understanding that police came into this man's home, his private residence, and arrested him on charges of sodomy. And he was found guilty of having a relationship with someone in his own home. And I guess at the time, sodomy was illegal, so he was found guilty. And did he go to jail? Did he serve time?
I don't know. He didn't serve time, but he did. He was arrested and taken to jail that night. And it was very traumatic to him. Yeah. I talked to him about it the day of our arrest. And it had a real negative impact on him, as it would anybody, obviously, if you were having intimate relations with your partner and
in your house.
A cop burst in. The story was that he'd been arrested for some open container violation. He was a bartender at, I hope I'm getting this right, the Cove bar. And he'd walked outside, had a beer in his hand, and this cop who had been lurking around, I think looking for trouble, nabbed him and arrested him. And so I don't remember exactly what the details were. Maybe Michael hadn't shown up for his hearing or something, and the guy went to his house, which seems really odd. And the roommate, Michael's roommate, said, "Oh, well, come in. You know, he's back in his room there." Well, Michael, you know, was back in his room with his boyfriend, and I don't know what the roommate was thinking, but this cop went in and opened the door a crack and saw what was happening and, you know, stood there and observed for a little bit and then arrested them. And for private adult consensual behavior. And I personally was so horrified that the Supreme Court basically said that was just, that was acceptable, that I felt like, you know, something had to be done to protest. So we went to the, we would have gone to the march anyway, just because, you know, I had been marching for gay rights and protesting for gay rights since I came out in 1980. But that was the extra kick, and that was the reason we decided to go ahead and do civil disobedience. And once we realized that Michael Hardwick was looking for a couple of other people to be in his group, and when they realized we were from Georgia, that made sense. And so we all got together and decided to do it. And the next day we went and got arrested.
So what exactly was the civil disobedience? What were you doing that got you arrested?
There is a law that you cannot do protests on the plaza in front of the Supreme Court. So all you have to do is walk up onto that plaza and sit down, and that's all you have to do, and you'll get arrested. And so the police had been informed that we planned, because there were quite a number of people who planned to do civil disobedience that day, and it ended up being, I think, the second largest civil disobedience. It was definitely the largest one they had had since the Vietnam War. There were over 600 people were arrested that day.
Oh, wow.
They were not prepared for it.
They
did not have the buses. They did not have the manpower to handle us at all. In fact, people eventually got a little impatient and were chanting, "We're tired. We're hungry. We want to go to jail," because they just had us waiting and waiting. The way it worked, each group, each affinity group would walk up onto the plaza and sit down and, you know, chant or something. And then the officers would come and drag people away, or some people went willingly, and as soon as that group was finished, the next group would walk up. So it was just wave after wave of people, and it was incredibly moving. It's hard to explain, but I spent most of the day in tears, and I'm not a big crier, but it was just so emotional and so moving to me to realize that I was not alone, that my little group of friends were not alone, that there were, you know, hundreds of other people, if not, you know, many thousands of other people who believed, as I did, that we deserved to be treated the same as everybody else. And there was something about looking up at the edifice on the Supreme Court that said equal justice under law, and knowing that that just wasn't true.
Right.
But we were going to do what we could to make it true.
Do you have a sense, so this was in 87, and you attended, you've been advocating and protesting for gay and lesbian rights since 1980. Do you have a sense in 2022 about when you felt like the tide sort of started to turn, whether on a national level or on a state level? Do you have a sense, like, what, like, what era or what time period that might have started to happen?
You know, it was a very gradual thing, and then sort of all at once, which I guess is how a lot of civil rights issues are. It felt like for a long time nothing was going to change, nothing, you know, happened. But I guess in the 1990s, ACT UP made a big difference. And in fact, ACT UP was the group that organized the arrest in Atlanta. And that was protesting the sodomy law that criminalized, again, same-sex, or it actually criminalized straight relations too, but they were used very selectively, usually used to harass gay people. So I think things, you know, probably got somewhat better toward the end of the 90s, and I certainly felt like they got better when gay marriage was legalized, and my partner and I went up to Massachusetts to be there the day that gay marriage was legalized in Massachusetts. That was the only state at the time. That was, I think that was 2002 or 2003. We went up there for that, just to watch other people get married, because of course you could only get married there if you lived in Massachusetts. There was no, you know, you couldn't go there and be married. And then my partner Claudia and I in 2003 went to Canada and got married, even though it really didn't have any legal weight here in the United States at that time. But we just wanted to be, we wanted to be legal somewhere. So we went to Canada and got married. And but, you know, I remember talking to my sister several years back, I guess, during the Obama administration, and just telling her how wonderful it was to feel that, you know, I could finally be a part of things, that I could finally be, I don't know, that I felt like I could be on equal footing with my heterosexual friends and family members. And and my sister, who is tends to be very blunt and not at all sentimental, said, "Oh, there are still plenty of people who hate you," and and you know, she was right. I was really kidding myself, because it just seemed to me during the Obama years that things were finally headed in the right direction, and that we, you know, we could be a part of the greater community. We didn't have to just be in our little gay bubble. But that really wasn't the case. There are lots and lots of people out there that still hate us and would be happy for us to be wiped off the face of the earth. And so that's a little, it's a little disheartening to see that now with all these changes in the Supreme Court. I feel fairly nervous that we're going to be the next target.
So abortion rights first and then gay rights, is that what you mean?
Yeah. I mean, they've already, just in the short spell of time, they've gone after abortion rights. They've gone after separation of church and state. They are, I think, about to rule on climate change issues. Yeah, Clarence Thomas made it pretty clear in his ruling on the abortion rights issue that he wants to revisit contraception. He wants to revisit gay rights, the right of just, you know, gay intimacy. He's not going to be happy till all of it is reversed, I think. So, but, you know, I'm only 61. I've still got a lot of fight in me. And if it's time to get arrested again or do whatever needs to be done, I'll be out there.
Absolutely. So you mentioned, I'm going to backtrack again. Sorry.
Sure.
Spinning.
No.
You mentioned
You know, I have ADHD. Yeah. So this is a normal conversation for me. So, you know, if it didn't go all over the place, I wouldn't be comfortable.
Good. I'm so glad. I'm so glad it's not just me. I'm very ADD. And I wasn't ever really ADD before, but I somehow as I age, I become more and more. But
yeah.
Anyway, I'm interested to hear about the your work with ACT UP, and you mentioned the arrest in Atlanta. Is that the one that occurred in 1990?
Yes.
You showed me your arrest sheet, I guess it was.
Yeah, it was. That might have been the receipt that they give you when you pay your fine. And it was very, very faded, but I kept that.
Yeah, so talk about that episode, that incident, to use my previous word.
That incident. that was organized by Chip Rowan, a gay lawyer, and he was one of the main people I knew in ACT UP at the time. And they did a speech at the Georgia State Capitol, and immediately afterward, several groups of us, I think it was about 60 people, were arrested, so much smaller than the D.C. one, but we were dressed in our pajamas and had our little blankies and went and laid down in the street and blocked traffic and were arrested for that. And but that was our protest.
And were the pajamas? What that? It's funny that you wore pajamas. What's the story about the pajamas?
If they were going to come into our bedrooms, we figured, bring the bedroom to the street. In fact, there was someone brought a big brass bed to the protest, which was, I thought, kind of a nice touch. But then somebody else brought some inflatable, you know, sex dolls, and I didn't like that quite as much because I thought that was kind of tacky. But hey, maybe I'm a prude. But, you know, they had a kiss in, but I was there by myself, so I had to kiss a boy. And my friend Andrew Wood, who is he's in one of the pictures that I sent. Andrew is now a dedicated cat rescuer. That's what he rehabs kittens and sick cats and stuff. And Jeff Graham is the head of Georgia Equality. And the other guy I didn't really know as well. I think his name was Greg Strickland. But that was our affinity group. And unfortunately, that meant that when we actually got to the detention center, I was kind of by myself. but, you know, I made friends with some of the other arrestees.
Right. Okay. So I was talking to somebody the other day about, so we, of course, are collecting, we collect artifacts, photos, stories, et cetera, from people from DeKalb County and also about DeKalb County. And I was asking this other person that I interviewed about whether or not there were gay clubs, gay bars in DeKalb. Do you have any recollection of anything in DeKalb County, or was everybody going to Atlanta?
I didn't hang out too much in DeKalb County. Decatur now is such a hot spot, but in the early 80s, there was really nothing much happening out in Decatur. There was a Pico camping center. That was the big, and a car dealership, I think, and maybe a little breakfast place. But there really was not much happening out in Decatur. And so I can't really remember anything in DeKalb that was gay, but, you know, maybe somebody would. I know there was the Digging Dykes of Decatur were a garden club that used to come to all the marches, and they would bring their little plastic toy lawnmowers that they would spit out bubbles.
Oh, how fun.
And they did these little, you know, coordinated maneuvers where, you know, they'd march along for a little while and then they'd all sort of break and do their little routine. And so, I mean, there were a lot of lesbians that were living out there, but there wasn't a lot in terms of nightlife. So mm-hmm. I used to go to, when I was in college, I went to a place called the Sports Page, which was on Cheshire Bridge. And, of course, there were lots of gay bars on Cheshire Bridge. That was a lesbian bar.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't drink and I didn't dance, so I wasn't a whole lot of fun. So I just kind of went there. I just kind of wanted to be around other women. Yeah. Yeah. Just
good for people watching. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But there were quite a number of gay bars that my male friends went to. The back street, I would go with them sometimes, and mm-hmm. That was on Peachtree, and Numbers, and Sweet Gum Head was a drag bar on Cheshire Bridge, and so, yeah, there were lots of them. They've all kind of died out.
Yeah.
I guess that's the downside of inclusion, is that there's not as much of a need for that kind of space anymore. So everybody just kind of hangs out together, but sometimes I miss it a little bit.
Yeah. So can we go back to your time? So you were at Emory, you were at the Carlos for about, you said, 4 or 5 years, and then did you
it
come?
Was, yeah, close to five. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you come to the History Center after that? Did you come here after that?
Yes and no. There was a long gap because the Carlos. It was right when I was working at the Carlos that I lost my leg in a motorcycle accident.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not able to find work for a long time after that. Because, you know, for obvious reasons, people, there aren't a lot of jobs that don't require some kind of physicality, and exhibition work does require, you know, being able to climb ladders and carry heavy stuff and, you know, carry valuable artifacts, and it's pretty hard to do that when you can barely walk without falling down, which for the first year or two, I fell all the time. So that was one issue. But also, a lot of places don't want to hire disabled people because they're considered a liability. You know, they're going to make your health insurance costs go up, and could possibly, you know, have an accident or something. And, you know, so it's hard to find a job as a disabled person. I did eventually get some work at Fernbank as a freelance mount maker. And I worked as their mount maker in residence for about 6 months to do mounts for their St. Catherine's Island ceramic exhibits.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Please.
Oh, no, just I met some very nice people over there. The Will Grew-Mullins is the registrar over there, and became friends with him. And then eventually, and his wife, Patty, who is a conservator, and they eventually came and did some work at the History Center when we needed some of our ceramics restored. So.
Oh. Very
good to have connections. Yeah.
So when did you start working here?
Let me see. When did I start working there? Gosh, you would think I'd have a better memory for dates.
That's all right. Do you remember how long you were here altogether?
Yeah, I think I was there almost 7 years. I mean, I think the first thing I did was work there as a volunteer. My friend Maureen Morissette had become acquainted with one of her neighbors who was on the board at the time. I don't know his name. But when he found out that she had been the registrar at the High Museum and the Carlos, he immediately said, "Hey, you're not doing anything. Why don't you come to the History Center?" And, you know, and help us get things organized a little bit. And so she worked there for a little while, and then talked me into coming to assist her. And we helped on a couple of exhibits that they needed a little tweaking. And, you know, it was nice to get back into it. And then Maureen moved away, and so then I was kind of on my own, and eventually, you know, Melissa decided to have me come in and do some part-time work there, and it went from part-time to full-time. So it
amazing how
happened a little at a time. Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah, you and I have similar, we have
trajectory.
The same.
Yeah.
We actually have the same trajectory, actually.
Yep.
So now you're back in, you're back in Delaware, retired. So how are you finding retirement? I know you've got your dog and you've got your rabbits did you have deer too in your yard?
Oh, we don't have any deer in the yard, but we do have foxes. And there are deer in the area. We'll see them frequently as we're driving around. There are a lot of really great opportunities to look at wildlife. We're not too far from a place called Bombay Hook, which is a really amazing wildlife refuge National Wildlife Refuge. And you can go and see foxes and eagles and great blue heron and all kinds of critters. And but yeah, in my yard I've had groundhogs and foxes and raccoons, possums, all kinds of things. So, but right now I have a regular group of foxes that come and visit, and they, we were made aware that they had been part of the neighborhood for a long time, this family of foxes. So they were already kind of habituated to people. And so when they came around, we didn't feel too bad about putting a little food out for them because everybody else does. So
aww.
Now they come and they eat
so
hard-boiled eggs. I know. They're so,
oh
they're adorable.
Gosh.
And they come and they have their hard-boiled eggs every night. And so we go through a tremendous number of hard-boiled eggs. yeah.
So what do your dogs think about the foxes?
They find them fascinating, and they also hate them. And they love to bark at them. Yes, I think that they are aware that we find the foxes very cute, and they find this offensive.
Yeah, they're jealous. Yeah.
But they like to, Alice particularly likes to sit behind the curtain at night and wait for them to come visit. And then she barks her head off, and which is why she's outside right now, because she pretty much barks her head off anytime a dog walks by, or, you know,
the wind blows.
A rabbit. Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. She's a good dog, but she's very vocal. So
very cool.
And yeah, well, we keep busy. We Claudia and I bake twice a week for the dog shelters, local dog shelters. The Humane Association of Delaware and the SPCA. They are very happy to get their treats. I think at last count we had made about 2,600 pounds of dog treats. We keep track just to, I kind of keep a little running list just to keep us motivated. So every week add, you know, weigh them and see where we are. I'm kind of hoping that we'll get to 10,000 pounds before one of us is too old to do it or croaks or something.
Oh my goodness, that's amazing. That's a lot of dog treats.
Yeah, especially since I never baked. I don't know a darn thing about baking, really. But I just did some Googling and figured it out, and the dogs are not critical. So.
Oh, that's so good. Thank you so much, Karen, for talking to me. This has been so much fun.
It's been lovely. Yes,
I appreciate it.
Love hearing from you, and I hope everybody there is doing well and, you know, thriving.
Yes, we are. We miss seeing you. So you take care, and we'll be in touch. We'll be in touch more.
Okay, Jennifer, you take care too, and give my best to everyone.
I sure will.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.